Good.
Yep. Let me get this up here. Okay.
And you still see me, right?
Yep, I still see you.
All right. I am going to hit the record for the video, and we will start.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. My name is Jeff Thompson, and I'm here today to talk with Chuck Howard, the author of The Organizational Ombudsman, and we're going to ask him a few questions, and he's going to enlighten us and tell us everything from why I wrote the book and some of the contents to it, and will, I think, at the end make you more interested and possibly want to purchase the book. I'm just going to very briefly tell you about Chuck, and he is a partner with Shipman and Goodwin, which is a law firm in Connecticut. He was the chair, and of course, Chuck, interrupt me if I say anything wrong. He was the chair of the litigation department from 1985 through 2000, and he is also an independent counsel for ombuds offices for universities, corporations, research facilities, and he's been doing that for, only about 20 years.
Just about 20 years, right. Okay.
And if that's not enough for Chuck, he's also listed as one of the best lawyers in America in the commercial litigation practice area. And on top of that, he was also listed as a Connecticut super lawyer, which is pretty impressive, Chuck. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. Happy to talk about the ombuds field.
Good. Okay, so I'm going to get right into some questions that I have here for you, and hopefully the audience will find them useful as well. First and foremost, Chuck, from the introduction, you're not an ombudsman. You wrote an ombuds book. Tell us why.
Well, I represent ombuds offices, and I have found that the term ombudsman is one that is very often misunderstood. And one of the reasons is because it's so elastic. It applies to different kinds of ombudsman programs, from the kinds that do investigations and are part of government offices, the kinds that are advocates for a constituency of some sort. But I'm talking about organizational ombuds, and they are the independent, neutral, confidential resources. And I thought describing what they are and how they work would help them, but also help the people that set up those programs.
Okay. So maybe tell me a little bit more. What was you've been involved in the ombuds field for 20 years, roughly. What was your motivation to finally actually put this book together, which, again, for those of you that can see it, this is not one of those books that you put together in over one night or two nights. This took a lot of effort.
This was a couple of years of work. My motivation was to provide a resource for ombuds to understand how all the pieces fit together, to understand some of the history. But also, I was trying to give it for the people who set up the programs and who work with ombuds, because I think they need to understand how they're different from some of the more traditional avenues. And so a lot of it was to educate them as to what it is and how it works and why it makes sense to have one.
Okay, thank you. One of the questions I was thinking of as I was reading it is, first, for disclosure here, I'm not an ombuds. I'm a practicing mediator, conflict specialist, and I have a great interest in the ombuds field. And then I was reading about how much work and effort you put into this book. And the conflict resolution field, I don't think, is one of the biggest industries in the country or world. And then I thought, wait a minute. The ombuds is a fraction or a small portion of the conflict resolution field. And I thought, who's the intended audience for your book?
Well, my belief is that an ombuds function could be used in a whole variety of organizations. They're already at lots of universities. They're at lots of corporations. They're at lots of other organizations, like the American Red Cross was required by Congress to have one.
Right.
They could be very adaptable to law firms, accounting firms, hospitals. So the potential for ombuds programs is very broad. And my audience for this is for the executives or administrators who would set up those programs, the in-house counsel, the general counsel, the outside counsel, as well as compliance officers and HR representatives. If you start looking at all of those people, it's a very large audience.
Since you are an attorney, there's a lot of the book deals with legalities and issues, where I think that's one of the many confusing things people have in regards to an ombuds office. And you mentioned quite a few different cases that have been handled in regards to ombuds office. How important do you think that knowledge is for an ombuds, or say someone from the other side, someone looking to put together an ombuds office?
Well, I think it's very important, because it, I guess where I come down is that the structure of an ombuds office is important, because unlike some of these other compliance officers or HR offices, an ombuds needs to be confidential. And to be confidential, you're flying in the face of a lot of the tradition in the law, because the presumption in the law is that all communication should be disclosed in a court. And here we're claiming that they're confidential. And so some of the cases I talk about, one of the most important cases is a case that I actually handled 20 years ago, where the court recognized a privilege, which is, you know, an ability to claim that you don't have to disclose something in court for an ombuds office. But the court also found on the facts of that case that there was an implied contract, that this was a program set up for employees with the understanding that it was confidential, and so therefore an employee or somebody shouldn't be able to come in afterwards and destroy that.
Right. And I'm sorry, you mentioned something important there that I think for the people listening and watching. You mentioned the word privilege. In your book, I think one of the things that you point out is privilege, and you point it out very well. And actually, who does the privilege belong to, if you want to tell us a bit about that?
Well, a privilege is, as I said, the ability not to have to disclose a confidential communication. And there's a long tradition in the law that things like attorney-client privilege are recognized, and so courts deal with that. On the other hand, there are some places, like in federal court, where courts can create privileges or recognize privileges on a case-by-case basis. In some states, they can't do that. So one of the things I go into in the book is how a privilege can be found for an ombuds program. And here it would be more like a mediator privilege. Under the Uniform Mediation Act and a variety of laws, the privilege in a mediation belongs to the mediator. Or put another way, one side can't destroy that. Well, you know, we believe that that's a better model than the attorney-client privilege, where the inquirer or the client would hold it. Here, there's this neutrality that ombuds have, and so they don't really have clients. They're neutral. One of the things I also go into in the book is the limits of privilege. There are whole ways that you can protect confidentiality without going to privilege. And even where there is privilege, I talk about the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution, because not even the attorney-client privilege holds up in the face of a constitutional right to confront your accusers. So I go through a lot of privilege, but also how you can protect confidentiality without privilege.
Okay. Yeah, and one of the other things I heard you saying, too, is I'd ask you about, although you're not an ombudsman, you speak in the book, you mention quite often, there's a lot of examples in here. And I think it's important to point out is the examples you give are real life situations. Obviously, you don't speak about who the party or the client is, but tell us about some of the examples or how you were able to get them.
Well, when I decided to write the book, and the question was, how do you structure a program to preserve confidentiality? I dealt with it on two levels. One, I dealt with the legal pieces for that, but I also felt that it was important for people to understand, okay, literally, how do ombuds deal with issues and why do people come to an ombudsman? So I think I gave over 80 examples, and all of these are real. I went to my clients. I went to organizations that were not my clients. They gave me examples. They're presented anonymously, so you'd never know who they are, but they're all real. And for example, you know, what do you do with a probationary employee or the workers at a local facility who have questions? You know, the probationary employee believes his boss is doing something against company policy. Well, he can't raise that without being at risk. The local workers at a facility don't know anybody at a higher level. They don't know whether the misconduct by the managers of their facility is sanctioned. There are other examples where people come to an ombuds as the last stop before filing a suit. One of the examples I give is where a variety of African-American individuals came to the ombudsman because they felt that their supervisor was harassing them. Okay. The option that they came up with was to have the ombudsman try to schedule a facilitated conversation with the manager. Well, when the ombudsman went to the manager, he was so relieved to have somebody he could talk to that at that point, the ombudsman gave the manager facilitated listening tips and mediation tips, and they never had to get to the facilitated conversation because he was able to change his conduct.
One thing I just want to jump in is for our YouTube viewers that are watching this, this will be the end of part one. You have to click to watch part two to keep watching it. And I just wanted to point that out because I don't want to end this here. We should keep going because there's a lot of information that we can talk about here, more about your book that I think is really important. And one of the questions that I had for you that I wanted to ask you more about, well, maybe actually just finish with that story if you wanted to.
Well, I was going to say that's one, but there are two other kinds of examples that I think are very important. One is a situation where people come to the ombuds with a test. I mean, the idea here is that people are afraid to come forward with either interpersonal relation conflicts or misconduct, and they're not sure that they're right. They're not sure how to do it, and for those things. And so there have been a lot of situations where people come with a little question just to test the ombuds to see if they're confidential, and only after the ombuds passes that test do they give the real fraud question or the other big question.
Okay.
And then the last one is, this is very useful for senior people in an organization. There are a variety of examples where vice presidents or very senior people who know they have a lot to lose want a confidential place to raise issues.
Right. So it's there's people from all throughout the organization,
right,
the entry level all the way up to the VPs and the presidents.
Right.
One of the things I don't believe I asked you before, but when you're talking about having representation for ombuds, how important is it for the ombuds to have outside legal representation than just, say, the attorneys or the firm that covers their organization as a whole?
Well, I think it's very important because, one, you want to make sure the program's properly structured. But, two, what makes it an organizational ombudsman work is to be independent, neutral, and confidential.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I've had a situation where a organization that's now a very good client of mine had their company lawyers try to file the motion for protective order that is typically filed by the ombudsman's office, and was met with the other side with a, how can you be independent and confidential when you have the same counsel? So this allows the ombuds office to work cooperatively, but to project in fact and in appearances, independence and neutrality. So I think it's very important.
Okay. Well, one of the things I was thinking of, again, I like showing this, by the way, to show how in-depth this book really is. I was thinking, I'm currently in a master's program at Creighton University, the Warner Institute, and I was like, you know what, this book would be great to have part of a program when you're learning about ombudsman. So how does that work? Do you think it would be appropriate for, say, master's programs or maybe different programs where they teach, like the IOA? Did you have that in mind when you were putting it together, and do you think it'd fit in?
I didn't really have that in mind, but I think it's going to be used that way. The book was published at the end of January, and I've already been told that it's the textbook for three different courses. One is an undergraduate course, one is a master's in dispute resolution, and the other is a graduate law course. So I think there will probably be more of that, because I really don't think there's anything else quite out there like this that's so comprehensive. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know something about it, I think this really is the best resource available.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you, Chuck. Let's see. What was the other thing? Oh, the other really important question I want to ask you is, you mentioned throughout the book and through the different rules for an ombuds office, and I wanted it for you to explain to us more. And I know it's in the book, but for people listening and watching, you mentioned when creating the terms of the ombuds office, how specific should the word harm be explained in regards to the exceptions to the confidentiality clause? Because I think that's one of the other massive potential areas of confusion, the confidentiality clause itself, and then when you use a word that I think could be vague like harm, what would your suggestion be?
Sure. Let me back up just a bit. The idea is that communication should be confidential, but under the Code of Ethics and Standards of Practice, they say that the ombuds can break confidence if the ombuds determines that there's an imminent threat of serious harm.
Right.
So one of the things that I cover in the book is where all of that came from. And there are a series of cases that came out of California many years ago in which the court said if somebody, especially in that the original cases, it was a therapist, psychotherapist, if somebody is aware of an imminent threat of serious harm to an identifiable third person, there is not just permission to disclose, but a legal duty to disclose. Mm-hmm. And that was picked up in the Code of Ethics and Standards of Practice. So the way the IOA, the International Ombudsman Association, has dealt with that is to leave it just as that, an imminent threat of serious harm. That's been interpreted in a variety of ways. I think that may evolve a little bit more, but I think it's grounded in this series of cases that are now pretty widely accepted everywhere and also codified in statutes in a variety of places that mm-hmm. people in this kind of a position, if you are aware of an imminent threat to an identifiable third person, you may have a duty, a legal duty, to make disclosure and break mm-hmm. confidence. And so I think there may be more development in the law on that as time goes on.
Okay. Which, yeah, and I realize it's an incredibly complex answer, and I think you answered it very well, but you also do go through it more in the book, and
I go through it in great length.
Right, exactly. Which is incredibly important, because I think it's important for an ombudsman or someone for the staff to fully understand that. I think we have time for one more question, so I'd like to ask you, in regards to the audience that you're looking at for the book, if, say, an HR supervisor, maybe a corporate executive, or even a university representative is listening or viewing this video right now, what does your book say to them in regards to why they should create an ombuds office?
Well, I think it can help them make their jobs better. The ombuds doesn't replace a HR person, doesn't replace a compliance person, but both of those are what we call notice channels. When you go to them, they have a legal duty to investigate and take corrective action. An ombuds doesn't. It doesn't have managerial authority. It doesn't do investigations. But it will be a place where people who won't otherwise go to those other places can go. And mm-hmm. so I think if you view it as a supplemental resource and as a resource that can work cooperatively, then what you'll do is you'll be able to do your job better, because the ombuds, and I have many of my examples that show this, the ombuds actually get people to the HR or get people to the compliance with a better sense of what the process is, or with better, more usable information. And of course, that's all the individual's choice. But by answering their questions in a confidential way, the ombuds can make people more comfortable using those channels.
Right. And I just want to point out, chapter 2 is titled, Why Should Organizations Create an Ombuds Program?
Right.
Which you go further into there. One thing I do want to point out to the people listening and viewing, this wonderful book is available for purchase from the American Bar Association's website, which is abanet.org/ABA bookstore/. Guys, if that's too long or confusing, just go straight to their website, which is www.abanet.org, and there's a button to click their store. And also, it's available from your firm's website,
you can get a link on my firm's website, which is www.shipmangoodwin.com.
Excellent. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
Well, just one final thing. I really wrote the book to answer three basic questions.
Okay.
What is an organizational ombuds program? Why have it? And how do you do it to preserve confidentiality? And so that's the title, the origins, the roles, and the operations. And I think the origins is important because it lets you know that some of the issues that we have in our major organizations today are not new. They're very important, and they've been around for a while. The why create it goes into demographics and technology and globalization, but also corporate governance, criminal law, employment law, and the pressures on organizations wrought by all of that. And then how they've dealt with it, whistleblower laws and policies, hotlines, and what's missing. And then in the how you do it, I talk about structuring and documentation and litigation, as well as the theories for preserving confidentiality. So I tried to build it simply around some questions, but it is pretty involved.
Right. I was going to say simple yet complex, because it's not a 20-page manual here. It's definitely, I think, valuable to the people. I want to thank you very much, Chuck, for taking your time to speak with me. And I hope the people that are listening and viewing this, I hope this has helped you. And if you're interested to get more information on ombudsman, the role of the organizational ombudsman, again, the book can be purchased at the abanet.org's website, the store section, or at the website that he listed his firm. I thank everybody, and I look forward to all of you being my viewers again. And Chuck, again, thank you very much for taking your time to be here with us.
Good. Thank you for having me.